This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 26th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, to mark the launch of Monocle's second hardback book, The Monocle Guide to Good Business, we'll be delving deep into offices around the world who get workspace design right. First up, we meet the man behind our very own Midori House.
You can't just design an office and then it's done. I think you need also the people need to really work on the environment every day and really try to improve everything every day.
Then we get a tour of the Tokyo offices of Wonderwall, one of Japan's premier design and interior architecture firms.
I think that there are a lot of things that inspires him or our staffs to work on beautiful designs, but this actual space is just a home.
And then summer might be nearing its end, but there's no need to put away the shades just yet. We meet the founder of one of London's best emerging eyewear brands, Prism.
So it was kind of, again, like turn people's ideas on their heads and think about things in a different way. Like I was saying, you know, optical glasses, why aren't they an accessory?
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. This week, Monocle launches its second book to be published by Gestaltum. The Monocle Guide to Good Business aims to showcase some of the best companies that are doing what they do well. Central to the book's global perspective is the world of the office environment. Layout, interiors, and space planning are an essential component in creating a successful company. Not only is good design a fantastic way to show off your brand and ethic, it also fosters enjoyment at your workplace and happier employees. To mark the launch of the book, we're going to take a look at some of the offices that we think define good practice when it comes to design. First, we take in an architect's perspective. Mac Architecture in Zurich has long been specialising in high-spec workplace design. In fact, the interiors of our very own Midori House is one of the firm's projects. Earlier, David Pleasant spoke to practice partner David Marquardt to find out what good design means when applied to the workplace.
David, can you give us a bit of a step-by-step guide to how to design the ideal workspace? I appreciate that it probably very much depends on the client, but when you're given a brief, what's the first thing that you do?
That's correct. I mean, it's very much about the client because every client has obviously different needs. But there is a kind of a common ground between like most of the clients once you work in offices and you meet in offices. So there is something that every client more or less has also in common and the same. And that's a little bit depending on the approach, but our approach is often something that we really try to get the office built so the user or the customer is actually in the foreground. So we try to really design it from the perspective of the guys and girls who are using it at the end. And that means also if you have like a life-work balance and you go to the office, we obviously don't want this office to be like a sterile environment. We want it to be something like a little bit residential so you can really feel at home, you can meet people, there is like a kind of a friendly atmosphere to it. Not too residential though, it needs still to be an office, so we try to find this equilibrium between something really residential and something very professional.
We'll talk about the finishing and the furniture a little bit later because I know that's something that you guys really specialize in. But firstly, I wanted to ask you and put the question to you. This is something that comes up again and again, Monocle. What's your feeling on hot desking and sharing desk spaces?
That's a tricky question because you cannot say it's good for everybody. But I mean, obviously you have some people that come in and they are only there for a week, a year, and it's not really economically worth to build an entire desk that is abandoned for most of the time. Still, I think the people need a workplace where they can identify, where they say, that's my little privacy area. A lot of people also decorate their desk, and I don't think that's a bad thing because they just want to show that that's their territory. And I think everybody has the right to get some kind of a territory. So if you have this hot desk, that's a good thing if you have like computer programmers that are in only for a few days and they just need to hook up to the internet. But as a standard working desk, I think it's pretty difficult to economize like 30% of the places and take away the privacy environment for the people.
As an architect, I just wanted to kind of ask you what the science behind this is. Is it something that you've just kind of learnt by experience? For instance, I think you've said before that perhaps the optimal kind of zoning of people might be 8 to 12 people within an area, like you mentioned, people's kind of private area, even if they're hot desking, as it were, in that area. I mean, how do you come to these kind of quotas and percentages and numbers, really? How's that process work?
I mean, that's something I guess always happened. And if you look into history and you look into society, you see that people always get together in a certain size of a group. And this group is kind of family-sized, not this three-people family. It's like about 8 to 10 people. So you can really trust and you can really exchange in a certain privacy environment. So you actually dare a little bit more. And if the group just grows to 100, people behave differently. So there is this size. I would say we know the size from ages before. So when we were hunting together, etc., I think that's something that we work with, that we feel comfortable in also in our world. So we wouldn't feel comfortable in an office with 200 people sitting just really in rows. But we really would make little groups. It can be 200 people, but with little groups, you can just identify better.
So we've got the optimal amount of colleagues and the space is set up, really. Now let's talk about how we finish that space and how we dress it. And that's something that you know a lot about and you put a lot of attention into as a firm. Tell us about some of the choices of materials that you might go through with clients to get that office really kind of up to scratch.
Yeah. So here I can say we have some materials, some design tools that are visible and others that are not visible. The not visible ones I mentioned before, it's the acoustic and it's also the light atmosphere. It's something that you actually, if you don't notice, it's well designed. So you don't notice it's too loud, so it's well designed. And on the other hand, we have the visible parts, that's the surfaces and materials. And I think the contrast is a very important thing. So for example, if you have very high contrast, I don't know, a white desk and a black screen, that's really tiring if you have this all the day. So what we try to do is really fade in more like natural materials. So the whole contrast in the environment is leveled out a little bit. So it's not really energy taking or it's not too loud. All these factors that we try to create an environment that is just really comfortable to work in.
And finally, can I just ask, what's your office like? What do you practice, what you preach?
Yes, we try, definitely. I mean, there is a philosophy where we, first of all, try to do everything every day a little better, which means that a process is never ending. So you can't just design an office and then it's done. I think you need also the people need to really work on the environment every day and really try to improve everything every day. In our office, we have it. We have also a good scale. We really want to be and to stay a family-sized office. So around 10 to 20 people, not like growing into like 50 or 100. That's something that's hard to do. And if we would grow, we would definitely do it in these different areas. So we would create different zones as well.
That was David Pleasant speaking to David Marquardt of Mac Architecture in Zurich. Next up, we're going to Tokyo, where Masamichi Katayama's design firm Wonderwall took up residence in its headquarters in 2009. It's a concrete box, three stories above ground, two below, on a quiet side street in the Tokyo neighbourhood of Sendagaya. Inside, it's very quiet. On basement level one, designers work silently at their computers on design blueprints, the only sound coming from a radio with the volume turned way down. Katayama's own office is on the third floor. Katayama has completed about 400 projects since he founded the firm in 2000, and so his personal assistant, Yumiko Shimizu, who was also the firm's PR director, offered Monocle a look around.
We're at Wonderwall head office in Tokyo.
We're actually standing outside because we're standing in front of the front door, which is how tall?
8.4 meter. It weighs a little bit less than 1 ton.
Yes.
And you open it by turning this wheel.
Yes, yes. I'm going to open it.
And we're inside.
We moved into this office in 2009, October. This place is totally designed by Karayama, interior and exterior. When Karayama designed this office, he said this is his standard. He's not putting any design into it. Because we work with different clients with different design, and we always have to be neutral. So I think that there are a lot of things that inspires him or our staffs to work on beautiful designs, but this actual space is just a home, actually, so that you can feel comfortable and can always come back and work hard.
I might point out that it's not a huge plot of land.
No, it's 40 tsubo, it's like 120 square meters. As a land, all five floors, it's about 550 square meters. So it's not big, but with only 20-something staffs, it's we're not really packed. All the artwork also is an inspiration for the staffs. And Karayama believes that being close with the art and beautiful art really is a plus to be an interior designer.
Okay, there's an echo in here because we're in a very large room with a very tall ceiling.
Yes, we're in the conference room of Wonderwall. This is the only place we have a double height, and we have a long table. It's actually two tables expanded next to each other and make it look like one table. It's designed by Charlotte Perriand, expandable table, and with the chairs by Le Corbusier. And we also have some animals installed on the wall.
Animals, the head of a moose?
Yes, right. Karayama purchased this in Daikanyama. And we also have a buffalo. And this buffalo is actually an artwork by Simon Fujiwara, a British-Japanese artist.
Okay. And there's also a pretty intense sound system in this room as well. Because Katayama-san, I understand, is a huge music fan.
Yes, well, I think he's one of the no-music, no-life person. He always wants some kind of sound. He even says that the sound makes a silence.
Along one wall, we have almost floor-to-ceiling windows. And these actually look out on the street. On the opposite wall, you have bookshelves that are hidden behind these doors, these thin white doors. This is part of the collection of 10,000 books, or more than 10,000 books.
Yes.
And so let's just open one of the shelves.
For this bookshelves, we store art and photography books, and it's stored in alphabetical order.
And is it Katayama-san himself who has chosen all the books, or do all the staff like pick?
Only Katayama-san does that.
He's picked all 10,000 books.
Yes, right. Okay, we're on the rooftop. We are located in between Shinjuku and Shibuya. We're overlooking the beautiful woods of Meiji Shrine, and we can also see the Shinjuku skyscrapers.
In the background, yeah.
Yes.
And we can also see the apartment across the street.
Right, right. But this area doesn't have high rise, so we have a nice sky view.
And it's a wooden deck up here. There's a wooden table that's been specially designed with an awning that comes out.
Yes, it's designed in Denmark and for the exterior furniture, as exterior furniture. And we also have a little garden with the succulent plants. Karayama sees this more like a sculpture than a garden, but it really, it's beautiful. We asked Kusamura, a Hiroshima-based plant artist, and to select all the plants.
And behind you, there's a sink embedded in the wall. Is there a reason for that?
Well, just in case we have a barbecue, we did install from the beginning. We have electrical outlets and water sink prepared for the parties. But Kanayama wants to do a party more often, but Kanayama travels a lot and other staff travels a lot, so we are not able to do it so often.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall taking a look around the Office of Design Practice Wonderwall in Tokyo. Coming up, we're heading back to London to go into the offices of Frieze.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
Welcome back to this Workplace Design special here on Section D. I'm Tom Morris. Frieze has come to symbolise one of the leading brands in the art world today. Its contemporary art fairs in London and New York attract thousands of people who want a taste of today's avant-garde in the most stylish and vibrant of events, while its immaculate magazines are published eight times a year. It's hard to imagine an office that houses these two very distinct practices. To add to the fun, Frieze's bureau is in what used to be a playground in an old Victorian schoolhouse. Monocle's Guy Lutz met with Deputy Director of Frieze, Joanna Stella Savichka, in the sleek offices in Shoreditch to see for herself.
We were one of the earliest tenants when the Rochelle School was turned by James Moores into a mixed-use building which accommodates both studios for contemporary artists, design, fashion designers, shoe designers, architects, and we took a lease on the top floor of the school, which was, I suppose it was the rooftop playground. At the time, when we took the lease, there wasn't a structure up on the rooftop, but there was an existing parapet wall. So we worked with one of our colleagues who is also in the building, Quinn Architecture, to build a structure to house the company. And the brief was to retain as much as possible the outside space, and they cleverly built a series of interlinked glass pavilions within the parapet wall. That's why there's a specific ceiling height. And then each of the glass pavilions, as you see, have sliding doors so we can open out onto a courtyard garden. So the original use of the top floor of the school as a playground is still retained in a way because it's a social space for the company, with all the offices facing out onto the courtyard garden and being able to move to the other side of the building without having to stay indoors, being able to walk outside and then walk inside as well. The courtyard has these almost Japanese-like sliding doors, which in summer months we tend to fight each other about whether they should be open or closed, whether the air conditioning is better than fresh air. But being able to jump out to, you know, take a breather or make a phone call or have a meeting on the terrace surrounded by all the lush planting is really special.
I can see it's a lot of open space, a lot of light. I imagine that was a necessary prerequisite when you asked Quinn to design the place.
Well, given there are very few windows onto the outside, obviously the view onto the inside courtyard garden is really important. Light's really important, I think, for making a more conducive environment to creative thinking. And this is a space which accommodates writers as well as all our teams that run the event side of the business. So we need to be able to create kind of a calm environment that's conducive to all the different activities of the business. And I think having the garden also is a massive contribution to the environment, how people feel about being at work.
And would you say both teams work closely together? You have lunch together and...
Yeah, the teams do socialise together, but the way they work is very different. So having a structure which essentially creates a visibility from one space to another helps permeate the sense of such fluidity and also collaboration. You know, the magazine is looking at the area that we're also looking at in the fair, so there is definitely an exchange of ideas, and having a fluidity in the building structure really helps enable that. The side of the office which accommodates the events is larger than the magazine. That's necessary because we have more people working on the fairs, but it's a little more public because people do tend to move between the different departments, whereas the design of the magazine is very specific, the seating area, because it's more about having an opportunity to focus and work in a concentrated way. So the magazine's desks are more enclosed and private for that reason. And in our founder's office, which looks onto the space, there are several examples of some contemporary art, of course, given that that's our area, yeah, but also all our publications and magazines on display as well.
Is there any specific furniture or space or finishing touch that is a favourite of yours or maybe the team?
Well, I think the conference room and library is very special because we're very lucky in that every gallery and museum in the world sends us their publications because, of course, they're interested in reviews, and we have a huge library with amazing books that everybody's free to spend time in. And in our boardroom, we have a lovely giant table surrounded by some Eames Hopsack chairs, but they're all in various shades of pink to red and the gradation between. They're a bit messed up now, but if you're feeling very design and specific, you can arrange them so it shows the degradé range of colour.
That was researcher Gaia Lutz speaking to Joanna Stella Savitska, the Deputy Director of Frieze in London. Read more about that in the Monocle Guide to Good Business, which is out now. You're listening to Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris, where I'm bringing you Section D, our dedicated design show. Still to come today, we'll be going to Madrid to look at some very cleverly designed shoes. We'll get a fashion update from Hong Kong and then pay a visit to some textile designers in Glasgow. In the September issue of Monocle, you'll find our annual Entrepreneur's Guide, and within its pages, a special focus on manufacturing. One of the featured brands is Muroexi, a smart new footwear label based in Madrid that has taken its own path to create the ideal shoe. With the aim of designing their shoe from scratch, young entrepreneurs Esmeralda Martin and Roberto Heredia formed a diverse team, including an industrial designer and a biomechanical engineer. While both the former and the latter had never designed footwear before, they leapt at the challenge. The result was a sleek, stylish shoe range that sold out within 3 months. Now, with production underway for their third collection, our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous sat down with two members of the design team, Andrea Caruso and Iñaki Cid, to talk about the unique design process and what attracted them to the project.
My name is Iñaki and I studied biomechanics in Barcelona, and I've been working into it for like 5 years now. 3 in a sports medicine clinic and 2 in Muroexi.
Hi, my name is Andrea Caruso. I'm an industrial designer from Turin, and I run a design studio here in Madrid for about 7 years, which is called Sisac Dalmas, and we do design products, interiors and furniture.
Esme and Roberto were looking for someone who knew some tips about how to make a comfortable shoe. And then they were looking for someone who actually knew a lot of anatomy of the foot or how a foot worked. So they contacted me, they explained me the project, and in the main phases of the project, I started doing kind of a report. So they gave this report to Andrea, and he took these tips and he started designing the shoe.
Andrea, when they approached you about designing a shoe, you were a little bit apprehensive because you'd never designed a shoe before. What convinced you to become part of the project?
I had to think about it maybe around 10 days and talking with my business partner. And at the end, since we do think design is just a methodology to approach things, and apart from solve problems, is also to invent and be creative on different points of view, then this really sounded like a new challenge to us. So we took it because actually we never did something before. Of course, at the beginning you're a little bit scared, but then if you start thinking about a shoe, at the end it's a product. So if you're a product designer, then maybe you never did it, but you should know how to figure out how to design it. And then usually to design a shoe, you spend maybe 2 or 3 months if you are capable to, and you have a little experience. We took 1.5 years. Roberto Esmeralda picked from the beginning people who had never designed a shoe, which reminded me, well, they also always tell the story about the fact that when Apple wanted to design the iPhone, they didn't ask a telephone designer to do it. Otherwise, they would have placed buttons and keyboards. So they chose a team composed by fashion designer, graphic designers, biomechanics like Iñaki, industrial architects, illustrators, and I think we had some artists as well. We are a bunch of people. We got together the first time and we immediately realized how rich was the design team, because everybody were asking the other people, like, how would you design a shoe?
What makes this particular shoe different?
Well, I think it's the best sneakers in the world, but apart from that, you can cut it if you want. I think the approach and the vision that all the people had designed it, it's something that somehow is reflected into the product. For example, it's a really light shoe. You can clean it and bring it to the starting point, so it doesn't never look old or too much used. It's something very comfortable that you can walk. I just spent 10 days in Milan and I said, I won't bring with me a second pair of shoes, I just would bring a Muro. And actually I was walking maybe 10 kilometers each day around the city and never got the feet sore. And so it's a great product if you analyze all the technical aspect around it.
Iñaki, talking about the biomechanical aspect of the shoe, how did you apply your skills to the design process?
Well, actually it's kind of easy, and when you think about it, it's kind of weird that a lot of brands do that, but you have to keep in mind that there are like 4, 5, 6 top tips that you have to remind yourself how the anatomy of the foot is. So perhaps you have to take the average width of a foot and then apply it to a shoe. If you look at your shoes, normally they are or really wide or really straight. The height of the heel is really an important point when you're designing a shoe, and there are lots of studies that said that the perfect height goes between 2 and 2.5 centimeters. So we have to apply that too. The insoles are really comfortable also, the materials are really soft, but they embrace the foot so that you have this like glove sensation. And once you have the design, then you go to the factory, and sometimes they were like, actually laughing at us, like, you're crazy, you can't do this. And that's because you don't know how to produce it. You can design a lot of things, but then you, when you came with those designs to the factory, they have to like take those designs and put them in the ground and said, okay, we can do this, this is absolutely not possible.
Does that laughter that you encounter, does that come from the fact that they just don't understand new concepts? Or is it just because you don't understand the manufacturing process? Or is it a bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both, because you go with all your illusion and with all your joy and you're like, oh, I have like the best sneaker in the world because I have drawn it here in the paper. And then when they see it, it was like, okay, you can do this because you can't seal it, or you can do this because the foot won't enter in the shoe, or you can do this because it's too light and it will break. You know, there are a lot of things like that. And that's because you don't know how to produce actually a shoe. So now we know, and with the second collection, it was much easier.
Are you always in agreement on the kind of shoe that you want to make, or do you sometimes get quite heated and disagree on the direction the design process is going? And how do you resolve those discussions?
Absolutely. I mean, place 10 people that you don't know around the table, and each one of them would design their own style with their own colors, their own materials. With a lot of work, with 1.5 years sketching, and I think with 2,000 sketches, so each one is numbered and at the end with a lot of work. So it's, and having the opinion of other people. So
the first phase of the project, we took all the team, we rent a house in the woods, and we went there to spend a weekend all by ourselves, the 10 of us. And it was like we were closed in a house all the time, talking about shoes, all the time sketching. And we came up with really great ideas. And I think that was like the seed that make all the process of the design.
That was Monocle's Madrid correspondent, Liam Alders, speaking to footwear designer Iñaki Cid. For our industry update now, we're heading to China to talk fashion. Shanghai has long been the focus of China's burgeoning fashion scene, but the second-tier hub of Chengdu is fast emerging as one to watch. Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, caught up with fashion designer Paola Sinisterra to find out more about China's next generation of homegrown designers and the emergence of a rockabilly movement in Hong Kong.
We get invited as Tangram to be part of the fashion week there. It's, I think, the second time that they do it, and it's organized by the Chengdu Council of Commerce and Tourism, and it's takes place in the same mall where the new Lane Crawford store that recently opened is, and they just basically invite different designers from all over China and the region, and then just invite them to show their collections as a way of, I guess, promoting the city, but also like bringing and fostering new talent in general. So there were designers from Beijing, there was designers from Shanghai, from Guangzhou, ourselves. It was not very big, it was only like maybe like 7 or 8 designers. And it took place over 4 days, let's say, well organized. And yeah, I think it's an interesting new thing that's probably happening there.
So the vibe in Chengdu, for people who don't know, I mean, it's clearly becoming a fashion capital for China in a way. Lane Crawford being there is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Throwing a fashion show with brands from around the country. What did you notice about Chengdu in terms of the design scene and the creative scene?
I must say that I wasn't there for a very, very long time, but like the general vibe that I got is that it's a city that is very hungry for new things, which I think happens with every big city in China. But I think that Chengdu has, it's interesting because it's big like Shanghai or Beijing can be, but it also has a very laid-back vibe, which I think fosters a little bit more the possibility of interesting creative things happening. Of course, the food is also wonderful. It's very sophisticated, very crazily spicy, but also very sophisticated tastes. The feeling that I got is that it's an up-and-coming city, and it's nice, it's beautiful, it's clean, it's fun, and it's just generally fun and laid back.
The Chinese design scene, the Chinese fashion design scene specifically, how have you seen that change since you've been living in this part of the world?
Well, I've been here for 6 years already, and I mean, of course, many local designers that have been doing really interesting stuff in the last 20 years or so, but I think in the last few years, especially out of mainland China, there are a few really interesting designers doing stuff. I mean, if you have to bear in mind that China for the last 20 years has been, or like even more, I mean, it's been the producer of silk, the producer of amazing fabrics, and of course, there's all the know-how of how to make clothes because they've been working with like all of the designers of the world. So what's interesting is that now you see younger independent designers finally getting a hold, being able to profit from that know-how, and they're doing really interesting stuff.
If we can talk through some examples of these cool young Chinese designers, if you want to highlight some brands that you find interesting.
Sure, let's start from the north. So we can talk about Vega Saishi Wang. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that accurately. She's based in Beijing. She's really young. She grew up in Shenzhen, I think, but then went to Central Saint Martins and then came back to establish her brand. And it's quirky without being silly. The tailoring is wonderful, of course, because she's in Beijing. She does really beautiful wool coats and stuff. But it always has an element of humor, which is really nice, like embroideries and herself. Like, I follow her on Instagram, for example, and I really enjoy what she posts because it's very creative, but at the same time, very laid back. So it's not like this sort of high-brow fashion, but just interesting. Then there's, for example, Miss Min, which is stocked in Lane Crawford, actually, as of this collection. She's based in Xiamen, which is also where Ports has been based for a long time, and apparently it's a very active textile and fashion center. And she's the total opposite to Vega, whereas, I mean, she does very feminine stuff. She uses the most beautiful silks, the most beautiful lace, the most... But at the same time, it's not dainty, which I really appreciate. And I think it's kind of like a really interesting metaphor of like the Chinese woman, sort of like iron fist with a silk glove. And her stuff is just, it's easy to wear, but it's also like really beautiful, very feminine, very sexy. And then there's Sigi Chen, who has a shop. It's a menswear designer. He has a shop in Shanghai and in Beijing as well. And he uses wonderful fabrics, like denims, and then really rough cottons that are waxed, and uses a lot of leather. And it's like, I would compare it a little bit to like Andemelumester or something like that, but with a very Chinese touch, but without being obvious or like gimmicky. So I really appreciate the stuff that he has. Very, very masculine, very sort of like rough. And he does women's wear as well, but even the women's wear has a very like masculine edge to it. And then there's the couple that does fixed out of Shenzhen. Their stuff is more conceptual, let's say, but also working with like a specific tailoring know-how, and which I think is very, very interesting. They won the Woolmark Award last year for Asia. I mean, I think it's very well deserved. They're really like into the research part of fabrics and doing interesting stuff.
A very different but similarly extravagant trend that you've been noticing here, you've been part of here in Hong Kong, is the emergence and popularity of rockabilly.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. How is that seen and felt, and what happens, and how did the scene come about here?
Well, again, I'm not a super expert. I just really enjoy it. Last year, I went for the first time to they do a rockabilly festival, which is organized by the Boogie Playboys, which is one of the local bands, and the crew of Start From Zero, who's very active in doing a really interesting cultural stuff that straddles between sort of like music and fashion and design here in Hong Kong. I mean, it's one of my favorite sort of like designer little cliques in Hong Kong. And they organize this festival where they bring different rockabilly bands from the region. So last year they brought a Taiwanese band, and then there was a Hong Kong band. There was a band from Beijing as well who was really good. And of course, like around all this music scene, there's all the fashion that goes with it. So the tattoos, the girls with the big hairdos. And what surprised me, and like what I really enjoy about this in Hong Kong, is that Hong Kong seems, unfortunately, a very superficial city in terms of aesthetics. So like sometimes you'll go to like a super fashionable party and like everybody's just really bored, just taking pictures of themselves, looking amazing, but just taking pictures of themselves. Whereas in these parties, like everybody looked amazing and they were having so much fun. Everybody was dancing. The music was wonderful. The atmosphere in general was just very friendly. And it's interesting because it's very homegrown. I mean, the Boogie Playboys, for example, it's a Hong Kong band constituted by just local musicians, and they're just very passionate about what they do. So an interesting thing. And I've heard that apparently in China, in mainland China, there's also a really big following.
That's Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, speaking to fashion designer Paola Sinisterra. Coming up, we're talking eyewear back in London.
A careful balance between power and proportion is key to the success of Grundig's expert designs. The innovative Ovation Hi-Fi system radiates expansive sound from the most micro of machines. With its Magic Fidelity sound concept, the compact disc and iPod player is designed for the ultimate listening experience in your home, bringing big sound into small spaces. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
Welcome back to Section D. I'm Tom Morris. Sticking to the world of fashion, next we meet a young British designer whose label Prism is making a big impact on the eyewear market. This week might mark the time when most people head back from the Med to their desks, but we're hoping for a bit more sun in order to don the brand's high-quality, uniquely designed, made-in-Italy sunglasses. David Pleasant went sunglass shopping with Prism founder, designer and ex-fashion journalist Anna Laub at her store on London's Chiltern Street.
I actually used to be a journalist. I was working in fashion, style, trends, travel, really, everything. And I had a lot of ideas of things that I wanted to do, and essentially a lot of the ideas crossed over, and I was looking for optical glasses for myself and couldn't find the exact ones I wanted, and so just decided to make them myself. And I think my idea originally with Prism was, I think it wasn't so focused on optical glasses as the only thing I wanted to do, but it was more focus of looking at functional products that have an aesthetic quality. That was the idea, essentially, for Prism in the beginning, and I started with optical glasses.
Tell us about maybe what's your kind of design philosophy, what's your kind of aesthetic, what kind of drives you?
I think a lot of the focus is combining aesthetics and function, and I think also if you dig deeper into that idea, I was really interested in using like really skilled manufacturers and doing it in a modern way. So I felt, and some people would say I was wrong, but I felt that I couldn't find optical glasses that are a functional product made in a really modern fashion forward way. And so I wanted to find really skilled manufacturers that, you know, had been making glasses in their family for six generations and use those techniques and try and modernise it. And I think that actually goes through everything that we do still, all the different products that we do today. It's like really looking at really classic ideas and turning them on their head a little bit to make them very fresh and modern.
This season we're seeing some waffle, perhaps talk us through that.
This season we've done textured swimwear, so lots of different surfaces, and you know, a black and white leopard print, a denim, and there's a few metallics in there, like Lurex kind of inspired. So yeah, kind of taking inspiration from like really quite modern fabrics and turning it on its head, really. So something you wouldn't expect to see in swimwear.
Going back to the glasses, there's a kind of multitude of people that are doing eyewear. How are you placing yourself?
When I started, there weren't that many people doing optical glasses, and that was the focus when I began. And actually, you know, stores like Dover Street Market and Colette and Net-a-Porter took our optical glasses, and they'd never sold optical glasses as a fashion accessory before. So it was kind of, again, like turn people's ideas on their head and think about things in a different way. I was saying, you know, optical glasses, why aren't they an accessory? You know, some people wear them every day. Why wouldn't you take more time to think about them than the pair of shoes that no one even sees half the time that you might spend, you know, £700 on? So it was like trying to turn the ideas on their head. And then, you know, we ended up doing sunglasses mainly because people asked for them. I was making samples for myself and my friends, and I did think it was quite a crowded market. But I realised that if I wanted them, my friends wanted them, stores were asking for them, that there was a little bit of room there. And I think there are a huge amount of licensed companies that own their own manufacturing, but they have the licenses for all these huge brands, and it's done in quite a kind of conglomerate type effort in a way. There are more companies now that are, you know, really independent and doing it in the same scale that we are. But I mean, our glasses are really made on a tiny, tiny scale. I mean, you can buy a pair of glasses in our store and they might be 25 made in the whole world, you know.
Can we go and have a look at them?
Yeah.
Because it's quite impressive just the range of different models that there are. I mean, talk us through some of the different range that you have.
Well, the classic collection, which is the collection that I started with, and actually, again, with the idea of doing optical glasses, the idea also was everything was unisex, because I just thought, you know, as a girl, you go into like a trainer shop and you always want the boys' trainers and the girls' ones are really crap. I think it's quite a modern idea to have unisex products. So the classic collection is really all the shapes boys and girls can wear, and those are optical and sunglasses. And they're acetates that we developed 5 years ago when we started. And now you might see them in other places, but we developed them and they're kind of really core part of our identity now.
And finally, you must have become quite expert in advising people what glasses suit them. Just as a tip for someone who wants to select some glasses, if they haven't got them already for the summer, is it about head shape, forehead, dimension? You know, how does it work?
It's always like a double-faceted thing. For me, it's like shape and then colour. It's quite simple. You know, I think if you've got quite a large face and a really round face, then you try and use angles to kind of even it out. So maybe, you know, if you've got quite a round face, you probably try the Sydney, which is quite angular and quite a big shape. If you have a really narrow face, then you know, you don't want something that's going to stick out too much on the side. So something like the Sol. Also, it needs to be proportionate with your face, basically. So sometimes you're either trying to set off your features, you know, like maybe set off your cheekbones, or like your eyebrows should be framing your face. You should be able to see your eyebrows all the time. So it's just like using your features and your face shape to balance things out, and also your colouring. So, I mean, some people can pull off any colour, but it also depends on what you wear, you know. I mean, I really treat sunglasses like I would wear a different pair of shoes according to my outfit. So I think you can do that.
That was David Pleasant speaking to eyewear and accessories designer Anna Lau at her London store Prism. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Design team Timorous Beasties takes its name from a Robert Burns poem about a mouse's nest. But the works of Glasgow-based textile designers Paul Simmons and Alistair McCauley are anything but meek. Their complex detailed patterns merge nature's bounty and urban decay, from bristling thistles to beautiful but bleak city scenes. They're reproduced in home furnishing fabrics and wall coverings, primarily by hand, on site, from drawing to screen printing to rolling, cutting and packaging wallpaper. They've collaborated with many creatives, including milliner Philip Tracy and singer Kate Bush, as well as corporate giants like Nike, John Lewis and famous Grouse, always maintaining their distinctive, slightly transgressive style. Susan Stone visited their design studio in Glasgow to venture into the heart of the Timorous Beasties.
I've always loved a lot of traditional textiles. I mean, there's some elements in textiles from the past that are really amazing. And I'm not saying that we should just live in the past, but certainly in terms of craftsmanship and drawing and, you know, sometimes even printing, I find all these sort of things quite interesting. And we try and sort of look at these ways of making or manufacturing and these styles and reinterpret them into the sort of in a way that speaks to us now. I mean, I guess one of the ones that we're kind of known for is the toiles. When you see one, you'll know what it is. It's sort of scenes, bucolic scenes of things happening on a fabric. Now, in Victorian times, they were very twee, you know, little shepherdesses, you know, leading little flocks of sheep up garden paths and all sorts of sickly things happening.
Star-crossed lovers.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, when you look at the original toiles, which were done probably sort of late 18th century, so 1770s, which was during the kind of Industrial Revolution, pre-French Revolution, and there's a lot of unrest. Obviously, people in those days, there's far higher amounts of illiteracy, and the images were much more important in terms of giving you a moral perspective on the world. Some of them depicted battles, some of them depicted murders, and often kind of quite scary imagery. And they're copper plate printed, so they're carved in copper, and it'll probably take a craftsman about a year to carve one single fabric. It turned out that really we didn't really change that much from the original toiles. You know, the first toile was in 2005, I think, and it was really just for a kind of almost like a joke. And we did it on Glasgow, which is obviously the city where we work and live. And rather than the twee images or images representing what happened 200 years ago, we did things that are happening now.
But let's go back and discuss what's actually in the Glasgow Toile.
There's some great parts of Glasgow that, you know, are either off the beaten track or parts that the tourist board would probably try and tell you not to go to. And one of which is the Charles Ray McIntosh Church, which is up in Maryhill, which is quite a rough part of town. We had that in amongst high-rise flats. The other thing is that there was a guy peeing up against a tree. And then from there we went on, you know, we did the Glasgow Toile and then we did the London one, which was very successful as well. London, you know, yet again, even depicting some of the new buildings in London made it kind of contemporary. So we had the Gherkin. Now we've popped in the Shard as well to kind of update it. We did Edinburgh Toile for the Edinburgh Festival, and then we did a New York one quite recently.
Now the New York one is intensely complex.
Yeah, the New York one, there was all the protests at the time when I started doing the New York Toile, and I kind of thought, well, obviously the Twin Towers was such a, you know, I actually thought about doing a toile before, you know, what happened to the Twin Towers, and kind of thought it's just, I couldn't bring myself to sort of really take that full on. I mean, you know, you couldn't really do a toile of the things falling down, and, you know, it would be actually really tasteless. So I kind of let it lie for a while. And then when the Wall Street protests, and I kind of wanted to do a bit of a toile about the protests that were going on at the time and sort of support them in a way. I kind of thought, well, you know, there's all these political toiles of the, you know, in their time. And I thought this is actually going to be, actually, I thought it was going to be a far bigger movement than it turned out to be in the end, which is a bit of a shame. But I quite liked the symbol of the Guy Fawkes mask because it reminded me of a sort of Greek drama masks, you know, that you have. So it's sort of, I'm always looking for sort of traditional kind of elements that you can sort of warp and change a little bit. And there was a great drawing that I found from an old Renaissance drawing, and it was some wrestlers. And it just seemed to fit the positions of the... There's two cops and one guy getting arrested. And you've got the backdrop of the New York Stock Exchange, which looks like a Greek temple as well. So it kind of looks like this big Greek temple, which is actually all about the money. It's all about the money. And you've got lots of poor and rich and lots of different things kind of going on.
I would say that everything that you do is very beautiful, but there's a sort of tinge of menace to it.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. It's a design problem in the first place to try and make something that actually is initially very ugly and make it kind of beautiful enough to want to buy it. And I think that was a bit of a challenge at the beginning. you know, let's face it, you know, nature is slightly kind of cruel, isn't it? And, you know, it's not all about beautiful, perfect flowers. I'm more of a kind of slightly decayed, chewed on maggot leaf kind of guy, you know? I find those sort of things a bit more interesting.
You've done these collaborations not with just with other artists. We mentioned Philip Tracy and Kate Bush, but also with pretty large companies.
Yeah.
You've got Fortnum Mason, you've got Nike even.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever have this sort of push and pull with them over your... what we said about the tinge of menace. I mean, does that fit
in? Yeah, no, that's a good point, actually. Yes is the answer. I like working within restrictions. But where it isn't so good is when you kind of have a vision and you kind of have work which you think is good and you've thought it through, and then someone comes along and says, you know, and it's always a sort of, it's a sort of like they're thinking about a third party that doesn't exist. So it's always like, people aren't going to like that. Actually, when we have tried to make something commercial and think about people, it's always when it's fallen flat on its face. And actually, it's always been when we've kept with what we think is right and what we think is good or fun or taking a piss or whatever it might be, that's when it's really worked.
That was Susan Stone talking to Paul Simmons at design studio Timorous Beasties in Glasgow. And that brings us to the end of today's show. It was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. I'm playing you out to mark our workspace special, plus that singer who collaborated with the Timorous Beasties and who's kicking off quite a busy week here in London. Here is This Woman's Work by Kate Bush. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Be God, you can call. I stand outside this woman's world.